Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Podcast time. Special one this week. Carnage, aka Gordo. I can't remember when I was introduced to Carnage. It's got to be about 3-4 years ago now. We briefly caught up online, slid into each other's DMs as we all do, and then we've kind of kept in touch briefly over the last few years. And I was never really into the whole scene that he was in. And then seeing him slowly move things to Gordo and more into the house scene, I've kind of watched him over the years, and I knew his story was super interesting, but I didn't really know it. I didn't really know anything about him or kind of where he came from. So I wanted to get him on the podcast, and this is a very insightful conversation. I loved having him on. This guy has worked his ass off for years and still is working his ass off, and it's super inspiring. Without further ado, Carnage, aka Gordo. What's cooking, man? We're live.
How are you, bro? I'm here in the sauna. I'm waiting for it to warm up. It's a steam sauna, so like I gotta put water, I gotta heat up the thing, and I don't know if you can see, but paradise is right there.
So you're in Hawaii right now?
I'm in Hawaii, yes. I'm in the beautiful state of Hawaii.
How long have you lived there for?
I moved here during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I just, in the middle of the pandemic, I live with my grandma. My grandma's 80 years old. Amazing. So in the middle of the pandemic, I was like freaking out, and then like we were in Vegas, and it was just, you know, it was just kind of like I didn't want her in a big city like that.
Yeah.
And then thank God that I've, you know, I'm 10 years into this shit. Mm. So like 10 years strong. So it was kind of like I had obviously the blessings of being able to just move, you know, in the middle of the pandemic.
Yeah.
But, I did it, and I bought the house without even seeing it. I went and did the quarantine here. I did 2 weeks, then went and looked at all the houses and all the lots and everything, and then didn't find anything. And then I finally said, fuck it. And I saw this house that came on sale for like 10 hours on Zillow. And I was like, I gotta get this house. Wait, I'm not gonna go back to another quarantine. I'm gonna get this house, and then it ended up being my dream home.
Amazing.
And now, yeah, it's like the most amazing house I've ever been. Craziest view. It's just beautiful.
I've only
keep this house for a
Yeah, I've only ever been to Hawaii once, and I was there for like 4 days, got food poisoning, but still had the nicest time ever. It's just like a beautiful place.
Well, you look like the kind of guy that gets food poisoning.
What does that mean, dude?
No. People, white guys like you always get food poisoning. Like, fuck.
Why is this? I need to hear your theory behind this.
I don't know. Just you guys, I don't know. It's just like, you don't really see, you always just see like you look pretty healthy, you know? It's like the most healthy, usually, people, the people who have like, eat, you know, like not too crazy. You're not like super fat or just like, you just had a normal guy.
Yeah.
And you guys are the guys who get fucked all the time.
Yeah, this is probably true. I get sick quite a bit as well.
I get sick. I used to get sick all the time when I was way fatter, but now I've been doing better. But I have like inflammation issues. So obviously I'm flying all the time, so that doesn't help. But then like cheese or just like random stuff will like make me congested, and like my body will like get just like, will just feel like
shitty,
just like certain things.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because you lost a fuck ton of weight.
Yeah, I lost 75 kilos for you guys. So you guys use kilos, right?
That's a lot.
Yeah, I lost a lot.
You feel better for it?
I feel great. I feel incredible.
What was the moment where you were like, I need to sort this out?
I mean, I've had a couple of those moments. You know, in 2018, I stopped. I turned off my phone. I went through like a real break, stopped drinking for like 3-4 months. I went to Thailand, my boy's spot, Sri Panwa, which is one of the most beautiful resorts on the planet. My boy owns it, him and his family, and I went over there, and he's like one of my best friends, and I just like, I was like, had a show in Halloween or something, and then like, I like woke up one day and it was just like all my boys were like came. It was like this, like in Atlantic City. Mm. And like all my boys, I woke up and it was just like, my boys are all passed out on the ground, alcohol and food everywhere. It was like, you know, like fuck, there was like a girl in my bed I didn't know. It was just like, it was just one of those mornings you just wake up, you're just like fucking just disgusted with yourself.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and it was just like one of those, it was one of those times, and I was just like, fuck, I felt just in shambles, I felt shitty, I was huge, and like, I was like, cool, I was like, whatever, like, I need to stop, and then I just turned my phone off, I told my mom, I told everyone, my managers at the time, I was like, I'm not talking to anyone, just shutting off, and I went to Thailand, stayed out there, and that was kind of one of the moments where like, I brought my studio stuff over there, so I was locked in, and it was just like, I was like, I need to get my shit together. Then I chilled for a couple months and then got back to it.
Yeah.
And it was around the time too, where a lot of like the EDM guys, a lot of the bigger mainstream guys were kind of just like all like having like, you know, they've been doing it for how long. And a lot of people, you know, I don't know. Personally, I think a lot of majority of DJs, and it's kind of like a normal kind of narrative that like a lot of DJs and EDM producers and just EDM DJs or just whatever, just dance DJs and dance producers, a lot of them are nerdy, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's like a known thing. There's a bunch of like nerdy guys who just like stay at home and like work on the computer.
Yeah.
That wasn't really my case. You know, I'm good with the computer, I'm good with making music, but I wasn't really never kind of like an introverted kind of guy. I never like stayed home. You know, I had friends, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. I was popular, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's one of those things that also, that's also one of those things that has helped me in my life, my career, is like my confidence, you know? Yeah. And I'm not the type of guy that I'm not going to get pushed around by some random fucking kid behind a keyboard. You know, that's just not me. I used to get in plenty of fights growing up. You know, I don't have problems fucking beating the fuck out of someone. Yeah. You know, that's the thing. Like, there's a difference. You know, a lot in that time, there was a lot of DJs and big producers and big guys who were breaking. Mm. You know, because they just wasn't used to being in front of people all the time and all that stuff. And obviously, after Tim died,
yeah,
that fucked me up. You know, me and Tim were really, really close. So that scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, I need to chill the fuck out. And that made me chill out for a little bit. And then I got back to it. And I started again, and I got bigger, and I got fatter. And I kept going. And then the pandemic hit, and I was coming back from, I was coming back from China.
Yeah.
I forgot where I was at. I was coming back from China, or I was at, I had my festival Rare in Myanmar.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, I went to Fisher's wedding.
Yeah.
And I was like, and that's when I was like at my biggest, I feel like. I went there. I felt insane. I had to go get a suit. I felt so crazy because I was such a big size of a suit. Mm. And then I came back from Myanmar. I stopped in Australia. I stopped in Taiwan. And I went in Taiwan, and I had this like new show that was called Grubbing with Carnage, which wasn't a good idea because I was just eating more food. and then I came back, and when I came back, I got sick when I was in Taiwan.
Yeah.
I couldn't breathe. Mm. And I got home and I started freaking out, and I was like, okay, I have COVID. I don't know what the fuck it is. Come to find out, I had gastritis, esophagitis, a hiatal hernia, and an H. pylori infection all at the same time.
Jesus Christ.
So my body completely shut down.
Yeah.
My body completely gave out. And that was the beginning of this change. Mm. And basically I couldn't eat. I'd wake up nauseous every day, heartburn every day. It was just bad. My body just gave out. My stomach was completely in shambles and I couldn't eat anything. And basically that was my journey. I stopped drinking. I stopped smoking weed. I just completely, I was miserable, actually. It wasn't like I started changing my life. No, it was like a miserable change. Last 2 years, bro.
Yeah, yeah.
Sick.
Yeah.
So, but because of that, I was home.
Yeah.
And I was home and I was working on music. And with all these changes and all these things, like my whole mental change, physically, mentally, emotionally, and musically.
Yeah.
Like, I just like completely changed my whole life.
Yeah.
Thank God it happened when everything stopped. Yeah. But as you know, and a lot of people know, that didn't really stop me from doing shows. The pandemic, yeah, yeah. I was still doing shows.
Yeah.
Because that was a time where everything was shut down. Mm. It was a time to evolve. And also with the politics, I'm not as I said earlier, when the whole pandemic thing happened and I was seeing like it happen in Europe too, where like people were getting called like plague rats and just like spreading, you know, you're spreading the thing. I don't give a fuck what anyone thinks. I will never, ever, ever give a fuck. You're not going to stop me. Whatever you say on the internet, it's not going to stop me from going and playing show. And the thing was, it wasn't like I was doing it for the money. I wasn't going out there and getting $100,000 gigs.
Yeah.
I was going out there and getting paid $5,000 and $6,000 and $7,000. Yeah, yeah. Me and Diplo were the only DJs that kept playing during the pandemic. And we weren't doing it for the money. We were doing it because we love DJing. And we have fans. We were going and playing in cities and places that were open.
Yeah.
So of all the people that were upset were the people that were in closed states at home and they were just miserable.
Yeah.
So of course they're gonna be mad, you know, but that doesn't faze me. And now if you look at it, you think anyone gives a fuck or remembers who the fuck was playing then at the time? No, nobody gives a fuck.
I think
a lot. The biggest problem is people give a fuck too much of what other people think, bro.
Yeah, but
that's the shit that ruins people.
I also think during the pandemic, it's carried on now, but everyone's extremely sensitive.
And super sensitive.
Yeah, and everyone, rather than allowing this, I say everyone, this is not the case of everyone. I'm massively generalizing. I'm saying certain individuals that they will put so much power onto their own opinions and will die on the fucking cross because of their opinions, and they won't listen to anybody else's opinion. And that's a way you kind of create a really unhealthy society, because no one's actually talking to each other. Everyone's just shouting at each other and no one's listening. And that's how you get to where we're at now, is you get a lot of people online talking a bunch of shit that actually don't have a fucking clue what's going on.
They don't. It's also, it's that, but it's also like, you know, it's politics and shit and agencies and promoters and billing that these people don't know. You know, they don't know about it. It's not as easy as being like, oh, play here. Why aren't you playing here? Blah, blah, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, I've tried to explain it sometimes, but it just never comes out right. So I just kind of just keep my mouth shut, and just let them talk.
Yeah, it's definitely it's definitely an interesting industry when you get behind the scenes of it and kind of work out what it's actually about. And I was literally talking to my manager just a second, and we were talking about it because the music industry, a lot of us are all friends, right? A lot of us are all really close. However, it's
there's circles of it. There's circles of friends, and then there's a lot of fake kiss ass, like, oh, because of blah blah or whatever, and just like fake nice or just being polite, I guess.
Yeah.
But then there's a lot of people who play, like, that's one thing that I always love to remind people that there's also a lot of friends. I have so many friends, so many different friends, but there's also a lot of fake bullshit that just 100%. People just are like, hey, you know, how you nice to meet you, blah, blah, and then turn around and they talk shit about you.
Yeah, yeah. But I also think there's part of it that it's still a business, right? And,
100%.
And if you go to most corporate businesses, everyone's just super cutthroat. And the difference between this industry and corporate industries is that there's a huge emotion attached to everything we do. And it's not just about making money. It's about creating fucking amazing art and kind of giving it to people and making sure that people have a great time, where corporations is purely about making money. But
100%.
Realistically, our industry is full on a corporate industry.
100%.
So you kind of have this like mixed, it's tough. It's definitely tough, but it's also fucking great.
Yeah.
I want to talk about, and I think quite a lot of people will be interested in this, I want to talk about how it kind of started for you. Because I know bits about you, but we've never really like had a conversation, so I don't know that much about you. So how did it all start at the beginning?
I was born in DC, Washington DC. And then I moved to Guatemala.
Yeah.
When I was 2 or so-ish. Moved to Guatemala. I stayed in Guatemala till I was like 8, 9.
Mm-hmm.
Moved back to America. I didn't know any English.
Yeah.
So English is my second language.
Yeah.
So whenever people make fun of me for like how I speak or typing or whatever, like people don't know, a lot of people don't know, but like English is my second language. Mm. So I fuck up a lot of times. Like it's funny, cause like, I remember I had that Razer tutorial thing that was like a big deal. And like the whole thing was like, everyone was like, oh, very much way, way louder. But that was just how, like, I was speaking, you know, that's just like how I didn't know English.
Yeah.
You know, I stayed back a year. I went to speech class because I didn't know any English.
Yeah.
Then I learned English and I started losing Spanish slightly. Mm. But then I moved to America and I got fat. I wasn't fat all the time, but I was eating McDonald's and all this American shit, and then got fat, whatever. And then lived in Maryland for a while. And then when I was around 16, I moved up north with my aunt, who I lived in Guatemala with. And my mother got me this FL Studio Bible, and got me the disc, the software. And I started working because I was living in the country now and I had nothing to do. I wasn't playing football. I wasn't playing football at the time. So I was just at home working. And basically I started fucking around with the computer because I had nothing else to do. And it didn't really catch to me. So like kind of like didn't do anything. And then another year passed and then I got back into it. And then I started making, and then I had a friend who was like a rapper up the street. And I kind of like, I was like helping him out. Like I would like make beats for him. And then I was like freestyling and rapping too. And, cause you, so I moved, when I moved into America, I, I didn't really, the only thing that was put in my face, my mother and my aunties and all my cousins, you know, was rap music and R&B and like urban music, you know? So like, that was kind of like my first thing. And I wanted to be, you know, a mixtape DJ. And, you know, that's what I glorified. I was watching MTV and MTV Cribs and 106 and Park BET and watching all of my favorite, you know, rappers, 50 Cent and Ja Rule and Soulja Boy and, you know, Diddy and all these people, you know, diamonds and jewelry, you know, like that's what I grew up, you know, thing. And, you know, like that's what I grew up idolizing, you know, was like these guys with all this money and jewelry and bad bitches, you know, and that was the life that like I grew up, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And that's like, and that is a very, 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 very small group of other individual DJs and dance music that grew up like that. Yeah. Small. Yeah. So you have me, who's like one of the only black guys that has done a lot and has accomplished a lot in the dance world, that, you know, that's
especially
why I wear my jewelry.
Like, especially in the EDM side of things.
Yeah, right? Fucking 95% white people in fucking EDM. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? And like, there's like a small group of minorities who have actually accomplished stuff. There's millions of DJs. I get messages every day of young black kids and Spanish kids that want to do it and look up to me, you know? And a lot of these things I do, and the reason why I've never switched is because I want to open these doors for other kids like me.
Yeah.
I don't want to open doors just for, you know what I'm saying? Because I grew up in Guatemala. I've seen, you know what I'm saying? Like when I was young, I saw a dead body.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like I've seen real, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, like I had people who lived with me and worked in my house that was really poor.
Yeah.
You know, like I've seen it from my own eyes. I've seen third world country. You know what I'm saying? So like I come completely differently. My mind is set completely differently. I didn't have a fucking, you know, my family crossed the border illegally growing up to get me a better future.
Yeah.
My grandmother crossed the border. The grandmother who I live with now crossed the border with five kids that were all 7, 6, 7, 9 years old, crossed the river, got granted asylum in McAllen, Texas with the Red Cross. They were dead broke.
Yeah.
My family, my mom and my aunties were living off eating raw fucking onions because my grandma couldn't feed five kids.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So like there is not a lot of fucking people in our industry that come from that.
I don't think there's any at all. And I think, do you think that brings a different work ethic to your life?
150% It's live or die for me.
Yeah.
It literally is live or die for me. My family, like that's like, and that's why I have my grandma live with me, because I want her to remind me every day of what the fuck she did and what she sacrificed so I could be here.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So like, I have a completely different fucking mindset, a different hustle, different determination to all of this. You know, that's why I have, there's so much emotion with everything that comes with me. Somebody fucking talks shit about me or says anything differently about me and it's completely false, I'm not going to just keep my mouth shut and be like, oh, you know, this guy, no, fuck you. You're not going to come and tarnish my name in all these years and all these fucking hours I slept and fucking working in front of a fucking computer to try to master my fucking craft that I'm working on because some other fucking other person has something bad to say or something negative to say. I'm not going to just keep my mouth shut.
Yeah. No, I tell
you know, and that's the type of person I am. And when people realize, see, a lot of people who, if any person has anything negative to say about Carnage or Gordo or whatever the fuck, they don't know me.
Yeah.
Everyone who knows me will speak very highly of me. If you ask anyone who knows me, because I'm a real ass fucking person, I have nothing to gain from me talking shit about you or me belittling you or me stepping down on you. No, I have nothing to gain from that. So if you show me love, I'm gonna show you love. It's mutual respect.
Totally.
Because at the end of the day, we might, in the future, because I've seen it happen. I've seen people talk shit about someone, and then 5 years later, that other person who was talking shit is way bigger than that person.
Yeah.
And that person's over there trying to piss on your fucking face because you shitted on them 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I've seen that happen.
Oh, over and over again. You see it all the time.
Over again. So I'm not going to be the type of person that does that, you know, and I have nothing to gain from it. So like, you know, like this upbringing and seeing my mom hustle and struggle as a single mother, do this shit,
and my grandmothers and all my aunties who didn't have the money to fucking live in a fucking in a middle class home. You know, it was 7 to 8 of us living in a 2-bedroom apartment.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it's just a different, I come from a different cloth, and thank God to my mother and my family and my grandmother, especially, you know, it's given me this type of thing. And look at me, like, you know what I'm saying? I live fucking well off. Obviously I've been doing this for 10 years, but you think that's going to stop me from slowing me down at all?
Yeah.
It's not.
Totally.
Because I have a lot to gain. I have a lot that I go against. And a lot of people don't know that, because we were talking about, they don't know the politics of this of this corporate world that we're in. You know how much shit I've dealt with being Black?
Yeah.
Like, and I hate because there's a lot of fucking artists of color that use this as like a scapegoat to be like, oh, I'm Black and blah, 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 blah. No, I've done a lot being Black, you know? But there's been a lot of shit, bro. There's a lot of fucking racist ass fucking shit, a lot of stereotype shit that I deal with all the time in this industry, but I don't complain. What the fuck is complaining going to do?
Doesn't get you anything.
It doesn't get me shit. So I'm not going to complain and be like, oh, because I'm Black, blah, blah, or I'm Hispanic, blah, blah. No. That's not going to stop me. I'm just going to keep working harder. So then when I do get whatever I'm doing or reach that goal that I'm getting to, I use that as motivation. You know, so it's just there's a lot of things that make me who I am. And, you know, like all these stuff has happened. So when I was 16, 17, I started making beats and I was doing this shit, and I was in high school and I was backed up a year because of speech, because I didn't know any English. And then I stayed back another year in middle school because I was just like not fucking doing anything in school. And my mom got really down. My whole family got upset. So then by the time I was in high school, I was almost 17 and I was like back and I wasn't going to graduate till I was 21.
Yeah.
So I was like, fuck. And I was playing football and football was going really good for me, but I was like short. So I knew that wasn't ever going to be a real thing.
I feel you. I feel you on that.
So I was like, all right. So I'm there in high school. I'm like about to be 18. They said, I'm not going to graduate till I'm 21. I was like, all right, I have to drop out. I need to do this music thing. Dropped out, went out to LA for a couple of weeks. Got an online GED test. My mom's like, are you fucking serious? Like, this is not, like, I'm not going to accept this. So then I moved back to Maryland, to get my life together, finished high school. And then I was, I think, like 19 or 20 by that time. And then after that, I moved back to LA. I got a publishing check. I did a publishing deal I had a song that I produced for ASAP Rocky and Theophilus London, which is Big Spender, which now is randomly really a popular sound on TikTok, but it's a remake of my beat, which is weird. But yeah, so I got a publishing check for $15,000.
Wait, can I bump in there? How do you go from being at school to then writing a record for ASAP Rocky?
Because at that point I was like, making a bunch of hip hop beats. I was just making hip hop beats. That's what I was. I was a hip hop producer and I was making hip hop beats. And I was in a, like, you don't understand how many fucking hours I spent on MySpace messaging people, messaging artists, listening to artists. Cause I was in Frederick, Maryland, bro. Like, this, you don't understand. Frederick, Maryland is like where I'm like, at Walkersville, Maryland. I was like 10 minutes away from Camp David. Like, I'm in the boonies.
Yeah, yeah.
All I was only surrounded by white rednecks, hicks. You know, like real, like they all look like you, real redneck, you know, huge beard, dirty, go to school. They working on farms every day. There was not that many Black kids in my school.
Yeah.
Like I was like, I had nothing else to do, you know, so then to like work on music, and everybody else was on drugs back then and shit, and pills. And I wasn't really into any of that stuff. Mm. So, opiates, not ecstasy, like opiates, like Xanax and fucking, you know, oxys. So all these kids were like on that. And basically I was in the middle of nowhere. So I was just like working on music and I was just like on MySpace looking at all these people who was popping and trying to just like doing my research and shit. And then I was cool with Theophilus London somehow through Facebook or MySpace, I forgot. And I sent him a beat. He was like, yo, I'm gonna get ASAP Rocky on this.
Yeah.
And that was like one of the biggest things. Like, oh, I was like, oh my God, this can actually work for me in my life, you know?
Totally.
So I did that and he got on the record and it was like a popping record online. That's when it was only blogs and shit back in the day, you know, so that happened. And I was like, cool. That kind of helped me to motivate me to fucking go and do more stuff. And then my managers at that point luckily got me a publishing check for $15,000. I ended up using that just to move to LA.
Yeah.
I paid six months off and then had the other $6K to live.
Yeah.
Fast forward 8 months later, I'm dead broke. I ran through the money. I have the house. My managers start paying for my rent for a couple months, which I'm then owing them all this money that they had to, they were paying me, not knowing. That's stuff that you don't know now. You know, I got this invoice months later and I'm like, what? I'm starting to do whatever. So, you know, then I moved I discovered this artist at that time, Super Duper Kyle, which is this big guy, Kyle. He had this song called I Spy. Huge artist. I discovered him. I discovered a bunch of artists at that point. G-Eazy before, a bunch of people. And I'm living, and my managers, you know, they didn't want to be paying for all of these people. So they all put us into this one house in San Pedro, which is Skid Row in LA.
Yeah.
So I'm living in the worst part of LA, downtown LA. With a couple of the artists, and that's when I was at my lowest. I was surviving on $100. I wasn't really talking to my family that much. I had a bed, a mattress on the floor, and my computer and my rockets, my Caracas. And I was just literally in the studio every day, 16 hours a day. Then I would come back to Skid Row down the street a block. The studio was a block up. And then, you know how in LA, literally it could be like Skid Row hell. And then literally a block away, it could be like a nice building. It's just weird. So the studio, I was working every day, 16 hours a day, working. Then I would come home. I would go to the studio around 12 p.m., stay there till like 2 a.m. in the morning. And I would be working, go back to my Skid Row, whether it be crackheads or prostitutes in the front, like just shit. And cockroaches on the ground. And just, that's another part where just me, I'm going back to living in shambles,
exactly.
You know? But that was kind of one of my lowest, you know, growing up, you know, in Maryland, I wasn't like living. I don't want my mom to hear this and be like, oh, you were, you know what I'm saying? It wasn't like I was fucking living in the slums my entire life, you know, but you know, we were living super, super modest, you know, in one townhouse, you know, with like 6-7 people in the house, you know,
Hispanic people,
we stack people up in a house, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever. But then that was when I was really living on my own, you know, I was eating Subway every day, eating Chinese food every day, $5 plates, pollo loco, you know, and just kind of living it like that. I was living and I was eating, you know, fucking eating ramen noodles and eating Subway and anything, you know, for the time I was living off $200 for a year, 2 years. And that's when I started making more EDM stuff, and I was making more. I mean, but you know, it goes back a couple years because, when I was in Maryland and I was like at home and then I dropped out and I was like, just like working on music, trying to get my life right. That's when I got into hardstyle.
Yeah.
And I got into hardstyle because of, you know, these, like, I had a homie who used to play me Above and Beyond a lot, and I fell in love with Above and Beyond, and I fell in love with trance, and I fell in love with hardstyle, and I remember they had these hardstyle Melbourne shuffle videos that were really popular on YouTube back in the day. It used to be like this compilation, and it would be all these like hardstyle songs, these big melodies, and I used to really fucking love melodies. I was really big on melodic. To this day, I'm very melodic. Every song that I've had has been very melodic, and I got into like, and I had this passion, this love for hardstyle and trance, Above and Beyond and On a Good Day, one of the best songs I've ever heard. And I was getting this emotion from, and all my friends were like drinking and stuff and listening to this music, and I was dead sober. So I was listening to this music and it was giving me this effect. And I was like, wow, I really like this music. And also at the same time, I was really loving rap music and stuff, you know? So fast forward, I'm like, around when I was like maybe 2011, 2012, I had been discovered by Niles, who was in this group called the Cataracts.
Yeah.
Which now you guys know this guy as Kashmir.
Yeah.
So Kashmir is the guy who really discovered me and brought me into LA.
Okay.
This is 2011.
Yeah.
Bro. So 2011, he was really fucking with my beats and really fucking with my music. And he brought me in, and I started there. I was his sidekick, yeah. helping him out on music, helping him out. This is production god Kashmir, we all know, yeah. right? So I was there next to him watching the Cataracts become the biggest pop group in that time. They had Like a G6, yeah, they had totally. Bass Down Low, all these classics. And I was there and I was seeing everything happen in front of my eyes and how the industry was and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I was helping him out on production and stuff, helping him out with tracks on their album. Mm. Cause I've always been heavy. It's just always been a heavy producer thing. You know, it always does upset me a little bit when people like even say anything about me, like not even producing or ghost producing, like that's where I come from. Like I'll put me in a room with somebody. I'll fucking go. I'll go in, you know what I'm saying? But because of my character, my personality grew so big that it kind of guys like me, are kind of looked at like we don't produce our stuff because we're just so, you know what I'm saying? And I'm also not one of those guys that I'm not going to stand, you know, it's rare for you to see going on any of my socials or anything where I'm like showing me making a beat or something like that. Cause I just don't need to prove myself.
Yeah.
You know, like kind of like that I'm like a producer and blah, blah. And I also taught myself everything. So if you put me and you ask me questions, I'm not going to know what the fuck this button does or this. I just know that it does it. You know what I'm saying? I'm not one of these super nerdy kids, as I said earlier. But I've done everything. I learned everything. And I taught everything myself with YouTube tutorials, as we all do, you know? But whatever. I start making the Cataracts. They start making more like, they were always making kind of like futuristic, dancey pop stuff. So whatever. So around that time is when One came out, Swedish House Mafia, and all these big EDM songs started coming out. And then me and Niles became so infatuated with it. And we were just like, listen to it. But he was making his pop stuff. So I had time to really dive into that stuff. And I was making like these like big, like I was listening to like Nicky Romero back then and David Guetta and, you know, Afrojack and Swedish House Mafia. And this one time, that bubble was exploding.
Yeah.
Because remember, I remember I'm not coming from dance music. I'm not coming from listening to all my life. I'm new to this.
Yeah.
So that stuff started going off and I started really diving in deep. Tomas Barfad. Do you know who Tomas Barfad is?
No.
From, you know, Who Made Who?
Yes.
Okay. So Who Made Who? One of the guys on Who Made Who is Tomas Barfad, who's one of the producers and blah, blah, the bald one.
Yeah. That makes sense.
He was working out of that studio in LA every day too. This is 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You can ask Tomas, ask anyone. He used to see me in that studio 14, 16 hours a day, working on music. Me and Tomas linked up a couple of years later. I released my song, November Skies. I'm skipping a big part, but November Skies, I just go back because Tomas Barfad, me and him, that was a record that he had. I flipped into his drum and bass record. I was making drum and bass in 2012, 2013. Wow. So there's a lot of shit that I could back up that I was doing that people, I don't ever have the time because I don't really sit here and try to prove everyone like, this is what I did. I did this. I was doing this before. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not that type of guy.
You don't need to, realistically. Like at the end of the day, you're doing what you're doing. You don't need to like prove yourself to anybody.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, I don't. So whatever. So Tomas Barfad was in the studio with me at that time. He was making indie house stuff, and I didn't really get it at that time. But whatever. Fast forward, I'm doing shit and I'm trying to get music going, blah blah. And then after that, at that time is when EDM trap started coming out.
Yeah.
And people like Tonight and Diplo was doing stuff like that, and Flostradamus and Bauer, and that whole Bauer movement started happening. And I was listening to that shit and I was like, that's exactly what I'm doing, basically, but just structured.
These big
808s and this stuff. And I was like, what? I was like really confused. Like all this stuff is just like.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
EDM trap, right? Mm. Then I started making these like big trap songs. But then if you, if anyone goes back to YouTube, you can go look at this thing called El Teke Teke, which is one of like my first like ever trap songs. And we, I remember we got it on Karma Loop. They released it and whatever. And I was like, okay, this is cool. And then I'm still in the studio trying to figure out what the fuck I'm doing. I'm making rap beats. I'm like LA. I'm like having sessions with like rappers and writers. Nothing's happening. I'm like a pop producer at that point, making rap beats and making EDM-ish pop songs. And basically I'm like there. And then, you know, this is around the time that like, I remember I went to a Luminox show and it was like in LA at Los Globos. And I wanted to go see what like this trap thing was about. And I went and it blew my mind. I was like, what is this? Okay, this is crazy. And then I came home and that's when like Hardwell Spaceman had already been out. This is an era when like EDM gold, you know, like this when like Ultra, these massive songs were coming out at, oh, you're seeing Ultra Festival and it was just crazy. And then Spaceman came out and I was like, let me flip this. Mm. And I flipped it and I was like, and I remixed it. I EQ'd the main sound. I was basically just making bootlegs at that point.
Yeah.
I would just speed up the song from 128 to 140. I would take the lows out. I would sidechain it and I would put trap drums over it.
Yeah.
And then I think one of the main things that happened was everybody was making these remixes and then I made it and then I labeled it Carnage Festival trap music because festivals, like that was a good thing I wanted to do. I wanted to play festivals. And this was like a festival remix of this trap that was already kind of already going on. And then because I named it that and I put it up on SoundCloud and it went viral.
Yeah.
And this is 2012, 2013. Mm-hmm. Go check when it uploaded on my SoundCloud, 2012, I think. And I started releasing a festival trap remix every Monday.
Mm.
And I'm talking about, this is SoundCloud at its prime when I was getting 100,000 plays a day.
Yeah, that SoundCloud so then that's was special.
Crazy,
yeah.
That's crazy numbers for SoundCloud at that time. 100,000 plays. I was getting 1 million plays a week on SoundCloud.
That's crazy.
And I invented this genre that was called festival trap.
Yeah.
And then it just started going absolutely bananas. And I got, at that point, I got really close with one DJ. His name was Borgor.
Mm-hmm.
And Borgor really fucked with my sound heavy. And he opened up. And at that time, I wasn't DJing then. Remember, I was just producing.
Yeah.
And I was having these remixes that were going viral. They were crushing. And basically, it was going insane. And then and Borgor goes, hey, you want to open up my tour? Mm. And I'm like, I don't even know how to DJ. But I didn't say that, obviously. I'm like, yeah, fuck yeah, I'll open up the fucking tour. And I locked myself in a studio with the S4 tractor and I taught myself how to DJ.
Yeah.
And I was using the tractor and I opened up his tour with Document One, him and some other, I'm blank right now, but Borgor was the first guy to open his arms up and let me in. And I started doing this. I started doing show and I was getting really upset because I have that personality where I'm like a winner.
Yeah. Yeah.
I need to win. And I'm opening up this tour. There's no one really there when I'm playing.
Yeah.
There's like, And then I'm seeing Borgor play and everyone's there loving him. And I'm like, fuck. I'm like, I want that. I need that. You know, like I, you know, so here I am fucking, trying to, you know, I, if you could go back one day, I'm going to go find, I sent this big email to my manager. It was hella sad, like 3 o'clock in the morning on a tour bus. Like I need to, you know, I want to do my own tour and blah, blah. And then me and Borgo, when we were close together, we make a song called Incredible. Mm-hmm. And after a while, I was making the trap stuff and I was doing shows. I started doing shows. I was getting $1,500 a show.
Yeah.
$3,000 a show. And I was making $5,000 a show. I started going up. Remember, and I'm still having to pay back my managers for all the money they put in, right? I'm like 25K deep in what I owe them. So like all this money I'm making, I'm finally making money. And like, I'm actually at zero the entire time. Right? I'm just like, this is just completely whack and I'm getting depressed. And then I'm like doing shows. And then I'm like doing shows. I'm doing these. And I'm like getting tired because I'm like befriending. When I'm doing all these big festival trap remixes, I'm befriending these guys like Tiesto and Hardwell and all these big EDM guys. And I'm like, you know, cool with them. And they're kind of like befriending me because I'm like the token black EDM kid at that time, you know, that was like kind of like friends with all these other guys, you know?
And then I'm like,
yo, I want to be playing like these bigger clubs. And I'm playing like these bass shows and like these like small little shows, you know, and I'm selling them all out because I'm hot. I'm scorching at that time. That's when Carnage was, you know, I was becoming the golden boy. You know, because then it really switched overnight for me. But then I'm doing these shows and I'm kind of getting sad. I'm talking to my agent. I'm like, yo, I want to do bigger shows. I want to get more money.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like what do we need to do? And he's like, you know, and I'm like, you know, and remember, I've always been making house music and progressive house and trance here, there, wasn't really good at it. But I'm like, yo, he's like, you know, well, the only way you're really going to make money and stuff is if you go and play at these like bottle clubs and stuff. And then at that time is when trap was, you know, at its biggest, but I was in my own lane because I had created my own genre, this own type. And there was a bunch of artists that were making, you know, Slander and Boom Boss Cartel. A lot of these guys like started making, you know, was looking up to my music going when I made the scene, and it definitely, inspired them to do their own stuff that they were making trap music, you know? But my stuff was more back then. The regular trap was very just, you know, it was just like small break, big drop, double the drop. And it was just like, it wasn't like as structured. Mine was like EDM, big boom, a big structure, a huge build, and this big fucking lead with the fucking 808s and whatever. It was a different type of trap, you know? So I was in my own lane. And the reason why also my trap thing started working a lot with the clubs is because I was remixing these big EDM songs and there's these big breaks. And it was like, you know, it was just two different worlds of different types of trap music. And then I'm getting tired of trap music.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I'm like wanting to evolve and I'm making a lot of, that's when Big Room was big.
Yeah.
And I was making Big Room music, Big Room type house music. And one day, me and Borgor make the song called Incredible.
Yeah.
And at that point, we're talking how this industry is, right? So we make this song and it's like this crazy song, dun da 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 dun da. It's this big, and we hit up Spinning, which Spinning was the goats back then at that time, you know?
The ones.
And then we're like, all right, we're like, get Spinning. Spinning's like, we want to sign it. And I'm like, oh my God, this is crazy. This is one of the biggest things ever, right? I'm like, Spinning wants to sign it. Spin is going to sign it. And Borgor at that time was a little scared because it was a house record. And he's like, this is when before Decisions, his Miley Cyrus song, this is when like Borgor is at its real peak of like gore step and like, you know, and he's like, you know what? Cause just because it's a little different from my sound, I'm going to let you go first. So it's Carnage and Borgor.
Yeah.
Right. We already know the politics of naming what name goes first and what goes name second. That's the stuff people don't really know about. Yeah. Right. So this is Carnage and Borgor.
Yeah.
Incredible. And this is huge for me. The song comes out, does okay. But what really changed everything for me was one day, I remember I'm living in Skid Row. I have a mattress on the ground, my KRKs. I wake up. I used to wake up around that time and I was talking to Martin Garrix every day. He was 14.
Yeah.
I'm an A&R. That's like my thing, my ear. I can find good music. I can find new artists, good artists who are about to pop. Mm. And I remember he came out with this song with Julian Jordan called B-Fam. And I was like, yo, this kid fucking 14 years old, like playing in a fucking privileged Ibiza. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Like this kid, I'm listening to this kid, blah, blah. But yeah, one morning I wake up and I check and I see, I don't know if it was 1001 track listing or something. And I see a video of Avicii playing Incredible. Mm. In the Armory in DC. And he plays it. And I'm like, oh my fucking God. I'm like, this is like, I should keep doing this, right? Yeah. Boom. As soon as Avicii starts playing it, then I'm on Club Life. Boom. Then he puts it on Avicii's show. Mm. And he's like, this is Carnage and Borgor Incredible. And I'm like, oh my fucking God. And I said, I need to stop doing trap music and I need to focus on making Eat Big Room and House. But then I stopped making trap music. Bookings stop because I say no to every booking. I'm getting around $5,000, $6,000 a show.
Yeah.
I tell my agent, which at that time he was like, you're crazy. I'm like, I don't want to do any more trap shows. I want to do VIP. I want to do club rooms. I want to do big festivals. I want to be on the main stage. Yeah. I don't want to be on the thing. By that time, I hadn't been on any festivals yet. So then I'm like, okay, cool. I'm like, I want to start making stuff. So I start making this stuff. I start getting a song signed on Spinning. I do one with Dimmack, with Tony Jr., which was a record that Steve Aoki. Steve Aoki was another one that really opened his arms. A-Track was one that opened them. Those are the three guys that really opened their arms to me and gave me a taste of everything. The Steve Aoki thing I skipped, but before that, you know, I was making this big room stuff and I was going and playing. I had a couple shows and everyone knew me for trap music. Mm. And I remember at one time I was playing Edmonton and at one point everyone was yelling trap, 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 because I was playing no trap.
Oh, really?
I was playing big room the entire time. Yeah. And people were like, play trap, play trap. And at one point I remember I tweeted, trap is dead or something. Then I remember like a lot of people got upset at me because, you know, people are living off the trap music.
Yeah.
And that's their life. And, you know, I remember me and Dylan Francis had like a small fallout because he was like, yo, like, that wasn't cool. You said trap is dead and everyone's making trap. And I'm like, fuck trap at that time. and you know, and I kind of just like abandoned trap music. Mm. And I started focusing on big room stuff because that was the stuff that was getting me. And I started getting like club bookings because I was playing only house music and big room music. Mm. And then everything just started going absolutely fucking insane for me because then everyone started supporting me. And then I remember I played Ultra for the first time and I played 2 p.m. on the radio stage. And that was one of the big moments too, when I went there, played 2 p.m. It was my first festival stage. And I was like, all right, cool. And I go there and it was completely empty. Mm. Gladiator was playing before me. It was completely empty. And I got there and my heart sank and I was like, it's over.
It's the worst
I swear
feeling.
To God, you, bro.
It's the worst feeling.
Three minutes happened. And I had that stage the most filled it's ever been in Ultra history.
That's crazy.
Adam from Ultra, the owners, everyone flocked there because everyone's like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
And that's when it got real for me. Mm. And that's when, boom, I started getting on all these festivals. But I was getting on the main stage because I was playing house music. And I was playing big room.
Yeah.
I was playing EDM. And boom, that's when I started this change when all these people were making trap and I was only making house. Ask any of these trap DJs.
Yeah.
I switched over and I started making house music. I started making Eat Big Room and this big stage. And I started getting on all the main stages. I was getting at 3 p.m., 4 p.m., 5 p.m. And boom, boom, boom. I was releasing song after song after song. And I dropped. And then at that time, when everything was going great, I dropped all of my biggest songs around those years, 2013, 2014, 2015, which were all rap songs. Mm. So this is when the whole, there's so many different things that go on in my life in the Korean Carnage, you know, a lot of my biggest songs were rap songs.
Yeah.
But I'm this EDM trap DJ that was playing big room house music. I had big room house songs, big songs, incredible. I had Toka. I had songs that has 50 million plus views with Timmy Trumpet and Kashmir. But I'm also having songs like What Do You Want?
Yeah.
With Uzi, which I discovered. Uzi, Lil Uzi, which is now one of the biggest rappers. I was the first one to really throw him that bone. I love Makoni. I like Bricks with the Migos before they were big. I had all these songs that were huge.
Yeah.
But then I'm still playing big room house music at these shows, but I'm known for my trap music. So then all these little things are going on, and all these songs that I'm dropping are going crazy. I dropped November Skies, which was a drum and bass record at that time. And I dropped my first album and it went number one. And then that was kind of the beginning of how Carnage got to where I'm at. And then after that, then all those changes started happening where I went from big room music to hard big room.
Yeah.
Which I was making hard big room with the crazy sounds like Boots House and Break the Fucking Walls Down with Junkie Kid.
Yeah.
I was making these like, cause I was like, all right, I still yearned harder stuff. You know, I wanted harder stuff.
Yeah.
So then I started making big room hard music. And then when everyone started making more big room hard music and I was on these main stages, I had already played the main stage at Ultra. I got fucking Coachella, Sahara Tent, 7 p.m.
Yeah.
I at that point, I'd played every fucking main stage in the entire world because I made those changes.
Yeah, yeah.
I've done it all.
Yeah.
You know, I've done a lot of these things and I did them all by myself. I didn't have anyone. I wasn't really anyone's real, you know, I didn't really have Skrillex or Diplo where it was like, yo, you know, I'm Matt Decent. I'm a Dim Mac guy and blah, blah. Like this is, I never did that. I always had it because I didn't want to depend on anyone ever in my life. So I'm playing all these fucking festivals. I'm dropping all these big songs and I start getting tired of big room.
Yeah.
So then I'm like, okay, I need to go back into what I really love. And I started playing hardstyle.
Yeah.
I started playing hardstyle and I start playing hardstyle at the main stages. And I remember having a conversation with Hardwell one time. We're at the airport and Hardwell's like, you know, we're headed to EDC Mexico. And he's like, yo, I'm loving how you're playing all this hardstyle stuff, especially all the Dutch guys and all the European guys are seeing this black fat American kid who plays trap music be on the main stage next to these guys where there's no other colored person on the main stage. Yeah. It's just all these white guys, Tiestos, WWs, and Showtex, and all these guys. And here's this one black guy playing the main stage, and I'm playing hardstyle where they grew up in Holland, and they grew up listening to stuff. And they're like, what the fuck is going on? I'm playing hardstyle. Then from hardstyle, I move over, and I'm getting tired of hardstyle, and everyone's, oh, but Hardwell's like, yo, I'm about to play EDC Mexico, and they told me I can't play any hardstyle because it's too aggressive on the main stage. They want me to play a thing, but I'm kind of jealous that you're playing hardstyle, blah, blah. It's kind of like a joke between us. And then I start getting tired. I start getting tired of hardstyle. I need something different. And then I make Sigh or Die with Timmy Trumpet.
Yeah.
And then I move over to Psytrance when no one else is making Psytrance. No one else is playing Psytrance.
I didn't know you did the Psytrance move. I didn't know that.
Bro, right. Sigh or Die was one of the biggest things because when me and Timmy Trumpet dropped Sigh or Die on all the blogs, everyone was like, what the fuck is going on? This guy, blah, blah. Sigh or Die goes number one. It crushes. Armin Van Buuren plays at the main stage, Tomorrowland. Another sign that I should do this. And then we start playing Psytrance. And then after that, what happens all the time? Everyone starts playing Psytrance.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Like, there are so many things that I led on the involvement and the change of all this stuff that people don't really give me credit for sometimes because I'm just not also that type of guy that's like, yo, I did this first. But a lot of the times, like, people really made those changes because I was the one that made those changes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So Psytrance happened. Go research that. Research when that came out. Obviously, Psytrance movement, that whole scene. But I'm talking about guys in my platform on the main stage at all these biggest festivals. No one's playing Psytrance.
Yeah, yeah.
I started playing Psytrance. And then, before then, I had dropped something that is interesting to you. This conversation is before then, I had dropped this song with Eric Murillo called Let the Freak Out, which was a tech house song.
Yeah, yeah.
This is in 2016, 2015. I dropped this song. Eric Murillo gave me the chance. He fucked with me, rocked with me personally, and we became really close. And I was like, let's make a record together. We made Let the Freak Out, which is a house record. This is the first real sign of Gordo.
Yeah, yeah.
go back to it. I've been doing this. Is not just me just hopping on the bandwagon. I've been doing this shit. Yeah. I've taken risks so many after time, years ago, and we dropped Let the Freak Out. Nobody really gave a fuck because it was just a record I just dropped and I just wanted to do it. Just do it. We dropped Let the Freak Out. And that's when I started going to Ibiza more. You know, I'm at the top of the world at that time.
Of course.
You know, yeah. I'm crushing it. I'm making 8 to 10 million a year. You know, these are things people don't really talk about numbers, but we need to let the people know this is real. Yeah. You know, like I was making dummy bread.
Yeah.
I was shitting on a lot of my colleagues from all these changes that I was making. I was fucking on a crazy level, you know. And it just happened over, and it was happening boom, boom, and everything was going crazy. And remember, we were starting when I was making that change from $6,000-$7,000 to making $150,000-$200,000 a show.
Yeah.
Well, like I really did this, and that also, you know, helps my confidence, is because I really did this all by my fucking self, bro.
Yeah.
You know, so thank God that this happened. But then you remember, we also got to remember that $150,000 show compared to my other colleagues like Tiesto and Martin Garrix isn't shit.
It's
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's like what people forget. You know, people, you know, that's the corporate side of it. Like, you know, you start working and whenever, you know, you get a job, you get a raise, you always want another raise. You know,
of course.
Normal life, you know?
I think it's also a huge thing. I can massively relate to this, is that nothing's ever enough in this industry. And I think that's actually more so based on what we do for a living. It's like we achieve one thing and then it's what's next. It's not let's enjoy it now. It's like, what's next? How do we grow from here? Because we know that we can't stand where we're at for the rest of our lives. We have to keep progressing, because there's going to be another kid coming up behind your ass that wants your job. And if you don't change what you do and you don't evolve, you're fucked.
100%. And it's you know, it's the business side of it, right?
Totally.
But yeah, so bro, like shit started going insane for me and everything's going crazy for me. And then that's how we got to that point where, you know, I've had my ups and downs. A lot of people I've dealt with a lot of shit where a lot of people try to like fuck me over and stuff, because I was by myself.
Yeah.
So I didn't really have anyone to lean on if something bad happened, and I could have someone leverage me for something.
Yeah.
I was the top head dog at my agency at Circle, which was Steve Gordon, who now runs UTA.
Yeah.
I was his bulldog.
Yeah.
You know, he had a lot of people that didn't fuck with him. I had a lot of people that didn't fuck with me because of how fucking confident I was, how loud I was, my personality, like, you know, and at that time, I'm not going to lie to you, I was fucking 24 years old, I'm at the top of the world, I'm making millions of dollars, I'm living it. Of course I was cocky here and there, I'm not gonna lie to you, you know.
Of course, yeah.
I've definitely pissed off a couple people, you know, but this comes from also coming from a place where I had no money.
Yeah.
I had no money. I'm coming from this place, so of course it happens to everyone. But you know, there was times where I was going against people that were like, you know, me to my advantage for bookings or billings or whatever, and I had no problem saying fuck you, you're not gonna do this to me. You know, I remember I had an incident with Gary Richards, which we used to run hard. I have no problem, we all cool now, but at a time where, like, you know, he did some shit that pissed me off, and it was just the way that he acted about everything. This is kind of the first time I'm ever talking about this in public, but, like, you know, he did some shit that was fucked up. And at that time, I wasn't going to let someone just like walk over me like that.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I lost and I snapped and I said, fuck Gary Richards at his festival that I'm headlining, you know, because it was just like he was also, you know, it was just some fuckboy shit. And I personally didn't like it, you know? So, and if you go to it, because there's been so many incidents that built carnage and this narrative around who I am, because people were just like, you know, he gets on the mic and his owner, the guy who owns the festival, he just says fuck you, you know what I'm saying? It makes it look like I'm insane or like some complete douchebag, but it was really because he had done some shit behind the scenes, and you know, and it wasn't cool, and he apologized for it.
Yeah.
So, you know, so then, and then it was just like hella shit was going on, it was just all bad, and I just like, and then the CDJs were cutting out and everyone on stage was acting really weird with me. And I lost it. I was just like, fuck this festival. Fuck Gary Richards. Fuck all this shit, you know? And that was just me being young too, you know, like that, I was growing, but you know, shouts out to Destructo. He's done so much. But you know, like it was just, there's shit like that happened that built who I was. And, you know, I learned from stuff and, you know, Yeah, it was, there's been so much has happened that has evolved me, and I've been through so much up and down. I've went through agents. I've went through managers. Those managers that I was with fucking were me over the entire time. Mm. I didn't know. And then I finally found out, I fired them. I had to owe them so much fucking money. It's just so much shit that's went on that's built me. And I'm so happy, and I wouldn't change any of it, because it's made me who I am, and it's matured me. And a lot of people, if you meet a lot of people that know me, they could all tell you that everyone's so proud of how much I've matured. And, you know, I used to be a fucking a loose cannon sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I've matured, and I'm so much more relaxed, and I've grown up in the music and all my tastes and everything. And my life has been up and down, and I'll soon put out a book or something with some really juicy stuff in there. I know all these guys, bro. Yeah. All these agents, all these owners, all these festival guys, all these promoters, every city. Like, I knew these people, and I want to know these people, because, you know, that comes down to future stuff with Taraka. Like, I know these guys, and I know the politics, and I know this shit, you know, and I'm very clear with everyone. I'm very honest. So no one ever can say, oh, this, or I talk to your manager, blah, blah, blah. No, talk to me directly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know it's all love. It's all good. And let's keep it pushing.
No, I respect that. And I think also what you say is how much you go through and things like that as an artist is a lot of people are coming into the industry and think it's direct success. And
it didn't help, because when I was doing all this stuff and I was grinding my ass off and blah, blah, it didn't help when at that time when EDM was big and all these people were coming in with money and they're basically getting ghost produced and they're releasing these records and having these big songs come out. It didn't help because I was such a loud character and such a loud personality that I got thrown into that group of those people who were kind of just, you know, in it for the money.
Yeah.
Doesn't probably produce his own shit, blah, blah, because I was such a character.
Yeah.
And before then, there wasn't really any characters like that. But that's what made me so successful, was that I was, when you think of Carnage, you know the fuck Carnage is.
Yeah, of course.
I can name you 10 other guys and you could be like, I don't really know what he looks like, but I've heard his music.
Yeah, yeah. It's a huge thing. So, we're in the public eye. And realistically, what you've done is you've created a persona around yourself, which is actually you, and you can't learn that. You can't teach that to somebody. You are that
that's how you're born.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going from Carnage. How did we get to Gordo? What was the whole process behind the whole Gordo kind of situation?
Gordo has been going on since the Eric Merlo thing.
Yeah.
And I put out that song. And then I'm going to Ibiza. I'm going there. I'm partying. I'm seeing that in real life. But at that time, remember, I was playing Ibiza too, but I was playing as Carnage. I was playing Amnesia, Ushuaia. I was playing, you know, regular Carnage.
Yeah.
Avicii had put me on his final shows at Ushuaia. And I'm like doing all this stuff. And I'm just like, I've always had a thing for house music. Mm. If you go back, if you ask some locals in Miami being one of the biggest cities for fans for me in the world.
Yeah.
I remember one time I was completely fried out and I ended up at Heart.
Yeah.
Heart was this club next to Space. And Eric Merlo's playing. I don't fucking remember, but there's photos of it. 2016, 17. I'm wearing fucking jewelry. I have my iced out watch. I have these crazy glasses on. I am in Heart and Eric Merlo allows me to go back to back with him completely fried out. And I played for about 30, 40 minutes, crushed it. Right. Supposedly is what everyone says, crushed it. And that was one of the first times that I got played, that I got it back to back. And that was the fact that Eric let me go up there and play with him was insane, because now that I'm into this now as Gordo, the politics of letting another DJ play back to back in the underground world is a whole nother story.
Especially like, no disrespect, especially Carnage coming into
100%.
And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way, but like,
you're, no, it's honest.
Yeah.
It's truth.
Yeah. You're Eric Merlo. Like,
Eric Murillo letting Carnage go back to back with him is fucking insane.
Yeah.
So this has been brewing. I've always loved house music, but I didn't get it. I didn't fully get it. I'm getting to the point where last year I finally got it.
Yeah.
We're talking 2021. Mm-hmm. This is 2016.
Yeah.
No, my bad. This is 2017 or 15. It's either one of those.
Okay.
Or maybe 15. I don't know. But yeah, I'm playing, bro. I'm liking house music more. I'm seeing, you know, all these house DJs, blah, blah, and this techno. And I'm just like, this is really cool. I really like this. And then when that break I told you and I went to Thailand, that was when I started making a lot of houseier songs for Carnage, letting people go.
Yeah.
Which is one of my biggest changes. That was kind of when I was like, all right, fuck it. I'm going to make this. I started making this house music. And around those 3 years, from 2018 to 2021, that was just the real change for Gordo. Mm. It wasn't Gordo then. Gordo just came last year, the name. I was, you know, like doing this stuff and turn the fucking, this is like real propane shit right here. Yeah, the 3 years happened and I'm like really start diving in. I wasn't playing as many shows. Mm. I had my festival Rare. We were doing crazy numbers that we were doing sporadically in Myanmar and Thailand and other places selling 15,000 Thailand. We do Rare every year. We do 15,000 tickets every year. Orlando, we were doing 15,000 tickets, which was the second biggest festival next to EDC Orlando. Mm. I did El Paso, Rare El Paso, 2 years back to back, highest selling electronic artist in El Paso. I did LA, Bay Area.
Let's go back to El Paso because that's what happened there because it's very random.
Super random. El Paso is like, I could run for mayor in El Paso, but when really? It's crazy. It's honestly crazy. And it's all Mexicans. I'm not Mexican.
Yeah, but
all the border towns in Texas fucking adore me.
Yeah.
And obviously because they're Hispanic and I've done so much charity work there and in Texas and, you know, working with Raices, which is a nonprofit organization that helps deal with families that cross the border, just amazing. Like my family. And one of the funniest thing is one of the cities where I'm really big in Texas, RGV, which is McAllen, where my family got granted asylum.
Amazing.
But yeah, whatever. The border towns love me. El Paso is like one of the best places in the world to play in, best crowds. Ever since I started playing there in 2013, I've sold out every show there.
Really?
They just really fucked with me. So El Paso is incredible. I was doing all the Rares and I was crushing it. And that's the time where I stopped playing a lot of these festivals, like the EDCs and the Ultras, because I was focusing on my brand.
Yeah.
I was focusing on my thing and it was doing really good. I was doing huge. I was one of the first DJs to start doing his own festivals.
Yeah.
In America, now it's kind of like a normal thing where your big artist does its one-off. First guys that was doing, other than you had your mad decent block parties that Diplo was doing that were crushing, but they were like block parties, you know. I was like this festival guy. I wanted a festival, you know. So I would link up with AEG and Insomniac and Live Nation, all these people, and I was doing these shows all over the world and they were doing pretty good numbers.
I didn't know the rest of was you.
Yeah, it was just did it all by myself. We did crazy numbers everywhere and still doing now. Myanmar, Thailand, Chile. We've done a lot of cool stuff. But that was like the whole Rare brand was hard EDM with a rapper.
Yeah.
So it was like, it was rapper, EDM. We had Travis Scott, Wiz Khalifa, Mac Miller. Mm. We've had everyone on the fucking Rares because they were all my homies. So they all, Ray Shrummer, Lil Yachty's, Migos, like they was all homies. So, you know, they would all come out and they, all these rappers would see me doing these big EDM festivals. They're like, we want to do that. You know, like, what's up with that? So like, they kind of love, you know, this is my life. Carnage's life is intertwined between rap, EDM, and underground.
Yeah.
That's been my life, you know? So the last 3 years I'm changing my life and I'm trying to figure out a new sound and try to figure everything out. And I just really start, I start detaching myself from EDM because I'm getting tired of it. It all sounds the same. I start working on more rap music because rap music at that time was blowing up.
Yeah.
Now we're at a time where rap music is stale again. Mm-hmm. The bubble, the rap EDM bubble moved over to the rap bubble, and now the rap bubble is moving on over to the underground house bubble.
I think what happens, and you'll probably be able to agree with me, and I think we kind of brushed over it, but what happens is something becomes fashionable and then everyone switches. And that's when everyone switches, you create a scene that isn't very creative because everyone's just trying to copy everybody. And you just get a stale movement. It's happened a lot over the years, and I've watched you from the peripheries for many years, and I've seen what you've done, and it's super interesting to see how, and also speak to you on now, but like how you've evolved as an artist. And how important that has been to kind of keep fresh. But what's really interesting to me is how you've evolved as an artist, but also taken your fans with you from beforehand.
I had a talk with Michael Julian the other day.
Legend. Love that guy.
MJ said that literally, he said it perfectly. He said, he was like, because we were talking about my shows, my Taraka shows. Mm-hmm. Which I've started, and my fans are if like, it's funny because they've all grown.
Yeah.
But like, I had, like, if you could go back and ask anyone that's been out in America or, you know, that's been DJing, like, I had one of the craziest cult followings in EDM history ever. Like, I had some crazy diehard fans, like crazy tattoos and just like crazy, would travel everywhere, like crazy, crazy shit. Because a lot of people related with me. It was it was a pro and it was a con. Because when a person like me is as loud, it's very easy to find out. It's easy for a person who's relatable to be like, oh, I like this guy because I fuck with how he rocks. But it's also very easy to be someone to be like, I don't like that guy.
Yeah.
Because then you have other guys. Think about all, there's so many artists, obviously. I let my music, the reason why I haven't fell off or haven't completely vanished off the island, off this planet, is because I keep coming out with good music, you know. Totally. Yeah. But if I didn't have music, I would have been gone for now. Because think about how many people are out there that have no face, no personalities, and just let the music speak for themselves.
Yeah.
That's all you really have to relate to that person is the music.
Yeah.
But I'm a human. We're all human, and a lot of people out there can relate with me because I've come from nothing and made something.
Yeah.
And I'm also, you know, like it's easy. If you can meet someone and talk to someone for 5 minutes and figure out if you like the person or not, 100%. You know, or even less, you know? So, you know, it's just been, you know, I've been trying to figure out, you know, that balance, and my fans have stayed with me. And the pitch that MJ said, cause we were talking about, I was talking about, you know, like, he was like, you know, you should get all these, you know, a lot of these artists on the shows, blah, blah. And he was like, basically all you have to do, really, you don't really go for the bigger guys, but you go for the smaller guys. And your pitch is basically is that, hey, like if I'm talking to Will Clark right now, right? Here's the thing, you're going down, right? You're your agent or whoever, you're trying to make the right plays, the right bookings, the right thing, whatever, right? So one of the reasons that I've noticed, and one of the reasons why I've kind of strayed away from EDM is that all of the EDM DJs, everyone in this cycle in America, all play the same venues, the same shows, and it's all the same bands.
Yeah.
If I'm pitching you and I'm like, yo, Will, I want you to come and play my show. Mm. What do you gain from that? Well, you're gaining 2,000 to 3,000 fans that have never heard you, probably will never listen to you ever.
100%.
So you're gaining a whole new set of fans that will come to that cycle that you're in and that you have to play in.
Totally.
I'm offering you new fans that will support you and love you and will come to your festival stage the next time you play at Boom 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 or Boom Boom Boom. I have thousands and thousands of fans that have never listened to this type of music before.
100%.
I'm introducing this. I have a school of kids that I'm introducing them a whole new sound, and they're loving it.
Yeah.
So the fact that they're loving it that means they're being, oh, I want to hear more.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
So I'm offering you the pitch that MJ said. It's like, basically, I'm offering you new fans that you don't have the ability to reach.
100%.
So why wouldn't a person come and get new fans?
I totally agree with you. And I think what we're going to be seeing now is more of that coming up.
100%. Especially how big the scene is getting.
Yeah. Oh, it's let's be honest, like Tech House, and this is no disrespect to the Tech House scene, but Tech House is now the new EDM. And
Tech House is the new EDM for sure.
And
100%.
And coming up very close behind Tech House is techno. And
debatable.
It depends.
In America.
Yeah.
In America. Americans are so off the grid with techno that it's hard. It's different. It's different. If you notice, but obviously that also comes from the helps of Chris Lake and Fisher becoming so big and spreading this more westernized tech house, the more mainstream tech house.
Yeah.
And then you have the guys like Trami and AC Slater and the bass, those are more like G house and bass house type of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I try to stay away. I personally, what I'm trying to accomplish is, you know, the authenticity, you know, because you also got to remember when it comes into play with this whole Gordo thing is that I've been playing. There's a small percentage of American DJs that got to DJ outside of America.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Back then, 2014, 2015, I was one of the first bass trap guys that played Tomorrowland.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
Because because American DJs don't ever cross over. Mm. You have Illenium.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cascades, Excisions. You think those guys sell half amount of the tickets they sell in America in Europe?
No.
Nowhere. Even Bass Nectar, who was a king back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would sell 20,000-30,000 tickets, would go to Europe and sell 800,000 tickets.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was one of this because of the changes that I made with the big room and all that stuff. I toured the world.
Yeah.
So I have a different mindset of how I perceive dance music and house music and techno because I'm actually going out and I'm seeing, because I don't want to just travel tour America.
No.
I want to tour the entire fucking globe.
Yeah, yeah.
So that comes with authenticity. And obviously, you know, the politics of these guys and how all these guys and all these fucking shows. And, you know, they're not going to fucking just let some American DJ come and, hey, you know, put this guy on the lineup.
Yeah,
that's just not how they think, you know, it's the politics. Of
well,
shit.
Well, that's one of the things I've come across is because I got bigger in America before anywhere else. Like everyone thinks I'm American.
Yeah.
Which is wild to me because I came up through the Dirty Bird thing. But it's like I've just got booked for my first homecoming show back in Bristol. First time I played in Bristol for 4 or 5 years. And it's just like it's mental to me.
I mean, bro, it's the American curse.
Yeah.
It's the American curse. You gotta be careful, bro.
There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's how do you get out of it?
There's nothing wrong with it, but you get stuck in that cycle, and then you're fucked.
Mm. Definitely. Yeah,
that's one of the reasons why I kind of wanted to branch Taraka off completely by itself and name it something like that, different and not American and not English, because I just didn't want to get in that curse.
Yeah,
I want my brand to be able to be taken anywhere, and no one be like, oh, that sounds like American.
Yeah. No, I like that. I respect that. Dude, we've just done an hour and 20 minutes.
Fire.
It's been amazing. Thanks for coming on here.
Thank you, bro.
Thank you, bro. It's been
a lot.
It's been really good. Is there anything you want to kind of promote or push? Tell people what you're up to?
It's Gordo season. It's fucking Gordo season. That's all you got to promote. It's fucking Gordo season. It's about to be the biggest year of my life.
Sick.
I'm about to drop the biggest fucking amount of music. I have some of the biggest collabs with some of the biggest artists and DJs in the world. This whole last couple of months, I've just been getting ready to go absolutely ape shit. And I'm about to go ape shit. And Taraka's about to go crazy. And I'm working on bringing, you know what? I'm not working on, I'm actually going to do, and I want you to remember this, that I'm going to bring one of the biggest techno parties in America.
Sick. Let's do it.
and Gordo's going to be behind it, and Will is going to be playing one of the parties.
Let's do it, man.
For sure.
I'm down for that. I'm down
Let's
for that.
Let's go.
Send me some music. I'd love to hear as well. Be good.
I got a lot of music to send you. Send me some shit. Let's work on something.
Sounds good, man. Sounds good. Mate, have the best time in Hawaii. Live that life. Enjoy it. You've clearly worked hard for it and earned it. So make the most of it. And hopefully see you this side of the pond.
Fuck yeah. Chee-hoo! Tony. Chee-hoo!
Big right, love, brother. Man. Take care. Keep safe. Right. See you soon.
Bye, right, bro.
Bye. And that's a wrap. Huge. Absolutely loved it. Thanks for coming on. Dude, it was amazing. Please go share, send it to your friends. Don't forget to subscribe and catch you soon. Big love.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.